From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, a look at African politics and literature from the perspective of one of Africa's leading novelists, Chinua Achebe. Also today, I speak with writer Elizabeth Benedict. Her new novel, The Beginner's Book of Dreams, is a coming-of-age story about a girl whose parents act like kids. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward remembers the brief resurgence of doo-wop in the mid-60s. And book critic John Leonard reviews The New Confessions, the new novel from British author William Boyd. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest, Chinua Achebe, is one of Africa's most acclaimed and widely read novelists. In 1968, he wrote, "It is clear to me that an African creative writer who tries to avoid the big social and political issues of contemporary Africa will end up being completely irrelevant, like the absurd man in the proverb who leaves his burning house to pursue a rat fleeing from the flames." Achebe has tackled those big issues in his own fiction. His 1958 novel, Things Fall Apart, is about his country's early encounters with Christianity and colonialism. His new book, Anthills of the Savannah, is about the failure of a post-colonial government in a fictitious African country. The leader who begins as an idealist turns into a tyrant. Anthills of the Savannah is Achebe's first novel in over 20 years. Chinua Achebe was born in East Nigeria in 1930 at the crossroads of two cultures, traditional Igbo and Christianity. This year, he's a visiting professor of English at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Welcome to Fresh Air. One of the characters in your new novel says that writers shouldn't stop at documenting social problems, they should give prescriptions. And another character, who is a writer, says in response, "Writers don't give prescriptions, they give headaches." Is that how you feel too?
Yes. I think that's one of the few instances in the novel where you can identify what the characters are saying with the way I feel, and that comes from the pressure which is mounting on us on
writers,
on creative writers. Yes, in especially in post-colonial areas of the world, to tell their people what they should do to be saved, you see, and to tell them not in the way that great stories have told, but in specific, detailed, almost ideological ways. And I think it is the duty of artists to resist. And this is why the artist and the poet in the novel is resisting. And of course, exaggerating, because this is part of the whole business of teaching, the whole business of prophecy is in fact to exaggerate. And so when he says it's my duty to give headaches, you know, this fixes it in the mind, which is why we use extreme images like that.
Are there headaches you're trying to give with your new novel?
Yes. I definitely. One of the most common features of post-colonial Africa is a sense of disenchantment, a sense of despair. We had come to independence not so long ago, thinking, as Nkrumah said, you know, "Seek ye first the political kingdom, and everything else will be added unto you." And it seemed reasonable, as recently as 1956, 57, 60, to say that. And our experience in this, the last 25 years, is that getting the political kingdom, so-called, does not solve all our problems. In fact, they create some new ones. And this is where we are today. And so to explore and expose this situation is not going to be pleasing, especially to those who are running the show.
Well, I think your book in part tries to answer the question, how can a government start off idealistically and end up ideologically and despotically? Was it a shock to you that that could happen when you saw post-colonial black governments in Africa becoming less democratic than the ideal?
Yes, but the disappointment is not simply in the area of democracy, because this is the way the West generally attempts to knock our efforts, you see. Lack of democracy is part of it, but it's not the whole story. Actually, I would even go further and say that it is, in retrospect, it is not surprising that democracy should fail in post-colonial Africa, because colonial Africa was not trained in democracy. This is one of the fallacies that is often projected. Oh, we taught these people the Westminster model of democracy, or we taught them this and we taught them that, and look what they're doing. But the colonial regime was not a democratic regime. It was a totalitarian regime in every sense of the word. And so there was no reason to expect that anybody emerging out of colonial rule would have absorbed the principles of democracy. So this is not the source of my disenchantment. The source of the disenchantment is that now we know. So what are we doing about it? You know, we've been independent now for 25 years. So what are we doing about it? What are the signs that we understand now some of the sources of our problem, and we're going to tackle them seriously?
My guest is Nigerian novelist Chinua Achebe, in his new novel is titled Anthills of the Savannah. Now, your novel is really told from the perspective of two people who were closely with the leader of this fictional African country. Now, after your country, Nigeria, got its independence from England in 1960, you became one of the heads of Nigerian Radio.
Yes.
Which was a government-sponsored radio. So that put you into a position of being close to the government. Did you have much freedom in that position, and was that a disillusioning experience for you, or was that a positive experience for you?
Well, it was both. It was both. Yeah, initially, there was this heady atmosphere, the feeling that we had arrived, that a new history was being made, that we were part of it, which had come with the last stages of the nationalist protest. And we were put in positions of authority. You know, I was under 30, you know, and head of our external broadcasting service. And to begin with, we didn't have too many problems. But within a few years, you know, power does this. You know, you were now dealing with local controllers of power, the ministers of information and the prime minister, who wanted to get more and more input into what was said. And the idea of a free, autonomous corporation immediately began to seem very, very difficult to maintain. I did, of course, struggle very hard to maintain my sense of independence. Not necessarily because I was anything special, but I think I understood some of the dangers and avoided them. I knew, for instance, that I must not get too close to the politicians. It was very attractive to be hanging around them, to be eating in their homes. And once you got into that position, the minister then didn't need to put anything on paper. He would simply hint at it and you would go and do it.
You know, one of the characters in your book makes the observation that the stereotypes that the white rulers used to have of blacks in Africa, the haves now have of the have-nots in Africa. And the character says, this is what they always used to say, what the colonists used to say about the Africans. You see, they're not in the least like ourselves. They don't need and they can't use luxuries that you and I must have. They have the animal capacity to endure the pain of, shall we say, domestication. Mm. Is that your observation, too, that it's now a kind of haves versus have-nots type
yes,
of
yes.
affair?
Yes, yes. This is a class problem being put in this kind of dramatic way. It is really the class system, which develops very quickly too.
Well, you're kind of in the have type of
position.
Yes, I am
this is what makes it. So
it's a real dilemma about how to behave in a way.
Yes, that's right. You know, this is your class. You know, you are talking about yourself in some ways, and you do what you can, you know, to minimize this tragedy as far as you can. But you know that it's not really something that one person can do. You frighten your friends and tell them, you know, tell them stories of great danger. Tell them stories of coups that are likely to come, military coups and so on. And in order to save yourself and save your friends. But it's something now, we know that it's something that probably requires more fundamental restructuring, that one person cannot do it.
You didn't write a novel for around 20, 22
yes,
years.
Yes, there
you go. You had said somewhere that the Biafran War, which was a struggle of the Igbo people to secede from Nigeria, was largely responsible, or partly responsible, for that hiatus. Why was that such a watershed experience for you?
Well, it was. It was a traumatic experience because of what happened. It's not just that one section of Nigeria wanted to secede, but the price that was paid to put down this attempt, the number of young people who were sacrificed in a very, very bloody civil war, one of the worst in modern history. And at the end of the day, you know, you ask yourself, what do you say to these people who were sent to their death? You know, we have this sense of responsibility for the dead. And in my traditional society, the person who survives in this kind of situation carries a huge burden of guilt for the rest of their lives, you see. And this is really what I'm saying, and that any society who allows this to happen has this problem of a huge burden of guilt. And for me, the history of Africa, which is really the base of my fiction, my fiction is an attempt to recreate the modern African history in fictional terms. And I have taken key moments, as you said, as when we began. First, the first confrontation between Europe and Africa, then the next generation and the next generation. And the book I wrote in 1966 ended with a military coup, which, as it happened, coincided immediately with a similar event in Nigeria. And so this last book was taking a new position in this history, the position of Africa under military control, what we're doing with it. And so when I stopped writing fiction in 66, it was really an attempt to examine all this, you know, what I had understood this history to be saying. How do you account for this bloodletting on this massive scale? How do you explain the hatred that allowed one section of the community to cut open pregnant women? You know, from what wells of hatred can this kind of thing spring? You see, now coming to terms with that kind of experience really needed a lot of time for me.
You said earlier that that you wanted to deal with the disenchantment that many Africans are feeling now. And the question is, how do you respond to military rule? You know, what kind of struggle is the appropriate struggle? There's a parable that you tell in your novel about the turtle and the leopard, the tortoise and the leopard.
Yes, yes.
I'm going to ask you to tell that parable and see how it relates to you.
Well, it's a very striking, very short story. The leopard meets the tortoise on a lonely stretch of road. The leopard has been trying to catch the tortoise for a long time. The tortoise is a trickster, and so obviously has been escaping. And then on this day, the leopard finally catches up with him and says, "Aha, now I've got you, prepare to die." And tortoise says to leopard, "Can I ask you one last favor?" And the leopard says, "Yes, why not?" And tortoise says, "Give me a short time to prepare myself for death." And leopard looked around and said, "I don't see why not. Yes, go ahead." But then instead of standing still and thinking, as the leopard had expected, the tortoise began to dig and scatter sand, you know, all over the road, you know, and throwing sand in all directions with his hands and feet. And the leopard says, "What's going on? Why are you doing that?" And the tortoise says, "I'm doing this because after I am dead, I want anyone passing by this spot and seeing all this sign of struggle on the road to say, 'A man and his match struggled here.'" And the moral of this is the importance of struggle, that we cannot guarantee, no one is going to guarantee us the outcome. Nobody is going to say, "If you struggle, you will succeed." It will be too simple. But even if we are not sure how it is going to end, what success will attend our enterprise, we still have this obligation to struggle.
Okay, my guest is novelist Chinua Achebe, who is a native Nigerian, and this year is a visiting professor of English at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. His new novel is called Anthills of the Savannah. We're going to talk more about his writing and about his life after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer Chinua Achebe is my guest. You've described yourself as growing up at the crossroads of two cultures, Christian and traditional Igbo culture in East Nigeria, where you grew up. And you said that you grew up at a time when the two were really separated, very distinctly, and your parents were devout Christians. What were the ways in which those two cultures were separated when you were young? What were some of the distinctions in the way the people in the two cultures lived?
Well, you see, it's a matter of the religion. My parents had accepted and been converted to Christianity, and so they abandoned the traditional modes of worship. They no longer believed in the traditional gods. They went to church. My father was actually a teacher and evangelist, so he traveled around and was spreading the gospel. And so we grew up in my family, and the same would apply to other families, Christian families, having a totally different way of living from our relations who stayed worshipping the gods of the village, the earth goddess, the god of yams, and so on, the god of thunder.
Were you told to see them as heathen?
Yes, they were heathen. Yes, they were heathen. And we were not supposed to have much contact with them, especially at those moments when they were celebrating their festivals. Because I think instinctively the Christians probably knew that these celebrations were more exciting than their own. Their rituals were more exciting, you see. There is a story that my great uncle, who was a very powerful man in the village when the Christians first came, and he was very open-minded about it, and he received them. He gave them a little corner of his compound to do their thing, you see. But later on, after he'd heard them singing, he said, "This is too sad. I mean, this sound is not good to be coming from a man's compound. So I'm afraid I'm going to ask them to move somewhere else." So the sound made by the Christian worship was not as exciting as the drumming and the dancing in the village arena. So I think one of the penalties you had to pay for being a Christian is to say, no, I turn my back to all that. And we as children were discouraged completely from going near. But there was also some ambivalence in this, because on other days when you are not having any critical events, my father's brother was still his brother. I mean, there was no separation. And if things happened which did not involve belief in God or anything, you know, they would behave like brothers.
Was there a turning point in your life where you had to decide, when you came of age, which culture you wanted to live in?
No, I always felt that the two belonged to me. See?
Both of them?
Yes, both of them.
So you didn't have to choose one for the
other? No, but I had to make an effort to revalidate the traditional culture. I even had to learn about it, because, you see, I grew up not knowing very much about it, even though it was going on around me. But there was this injunction on us not to pay too much attention.
So you were almost living in exile from your culture.
Yes. But you also had the possibility of sneaking out. You know, as children, we often did this. You know, my younger sister and I would sneak out and go and eat the food that our neighbors were cooking on their festivals, you know, just to see whether it tasted any different, as we were told, and it didn't. You know.
When you started reading, and you wanted to read fiction that was set in your country, was it usually fiction written by English authors?
Yes. Yes, that was the revolution was gradual, but I think the key moment, and this was the moment when perhaps the decision was taken instinctively that I must write, was the moment I realized that those stories which I read, like Rider Haggard, like John Buchan's Prester John, those colonial novels in which the good white explorer or the good white missionary went and lived among the savages, you know, at great danger to himself, that these stories were not as simple or as innocent as I had assumed. As a child, you see, you automatically identified with the good people, with the missionaries, with the explorers, because that's the way the story was arranged. Now, the moment you realize that you were not really of the party of the white man, but of the party of the savages, the moment you realize that if you read The Heart of Darkness, you were not on that steamer with Marlowe and his crew, but you were one of those jumping on the shore, that's the moment when you knew that a new story had to be written.
And you wanted to write those stories.
Yes, and you had to write it.
My guest is novelist Chinua Achebe. Now, when writing those stories, I think traditionally the writer in Western cultures is somewhat outside of the culture, looking in, observing the culture from a distance, writing alone. Writers always describe writing as a very lonely existence. I think the role of the storyteller in African culture is one of being at the center of the society, where it's a much more social role than the writer's role, and a much more kind of part of ongoing community life. Which part which did you see yourself as the storyteller, an integral part of the community, kind of passing on community history, or as that writer being somewhat outside of the culture, looking at it, observing it at a distance?
Well, I think what has happened in the West is really a distortion of the real, of the proper role of the artist in society. Admittedly, there is need for a certain distancing, a certain standing back, a certain going away in order to think, moments for introspection and so on. But art is a public thing. Art which ceases to see itself as related to people for whom this art is made, I think is really failing and is almost doomed. And so it's really a matter of getting the right balance. I accept this need from time to time to move away, but I think that the basic function of art is a social thing, and the storyteller is there because there are people to tell stories to. Our ancestors created these stories in order to make our passage through the world easier, not more difficult.
You said at the beginning of the interview that you do think it's part of the writer's job to give headaches, not prescriptions. Have you given the governments of your countries the kind of headaches where they've tried to get you out of there or arrest you or punish you in any way?
Well, I've done my bit, and I go on doing it. I mean, there is this book, Ant Hills of the Savannah, I think is causing some people a lot of concern, and there's a lot of running around, but nothing yet which I can complain about. No, the relationship between the emperor and the artist is a very, very tricky one, and one learns to live with it that way. You don't improve it by moving out and saying, "Oh no, I will move away from society and look in and talk only about general things like the condition of civilization." Because the emperor would be very happy for you to do that. It's when you are really dealing with things which relate immediately to the way society is managed that the emperor gets very, very mad at you. And so in that situation, you can expect all kinds of difficulties, depending on the emperor, depending on all kinds of things, depending on your own reputation, depending on your reputation with the people. So this is not something where you can be categorical.
We only have a few seconds left, but your new novel is set in a fictional country. Is that so as to not alienate too much to the emperor?
No, not that. I think what I'm trying to do there is to make it not just the story of one country, but the story of many countries.
Okay. I guess just have a couple of more seconds left. I want to thank you very much for joining us and for speaking with us. Will you be returning to Nigeria after being a visiting professor at the University of Massachusetts?
Yes, I'm going back at the end of this in the summer this year. Yes, but I've had a good time, and thank you for asking me to come and talk here.
Thanks for being here. My guest has been Nigerian novelist Chinua Achebe. His new book, Ant Hills of the Savannah, has recently been published by Doubleday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with television critic Peter J. Boyer. His new book is titled Who Killed CBS? The Undoing of America's Number One News Network. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, a novel that tries to answer the question, what would it be like to grow up if your mother was a dead ringer for Lauren Bacall and was also an alcoholic who was always bringing home a new man? We hear from Elizabeth Benedict, the author of A Beginner's Book of Dreams. Also, rock historian Ed Ward examines one of the less noticed reactions to the British invasion, the brief resurgence of a cappella groups. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new novel from British writer William Boyd. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. A 9-day-old strike by Polish shipyard workers in Gdansk ended today when workers made a dramatic exit from the Lenin shipyard without a settlement of their demands. NPR's Bill Buesenberg has the story.
In a sense, the shipyard strikers folded their tents and declared a moral victory tonight. Led by flags, banners, and a cross, they voluntarily marched out of the shipyard 1,000 strong and peacefully past the blockade of riot police. Townspeople applauded along their route. Church bells rang. At a nearby church closely linked with Solidarity, the crowd cheered, "We thank you, we thank you." A statement from the strike committee said, "We leave not in triumph, but with raised heads. Our strike should make everyone aware that one has to fight. It's a new spring for Solidarity." In fact, this was a defeat for Solidarity's demand for recognition as an independent union. The workers were able to negotiate directly with management, but they were not able to mobilize the nation as they had hoped. Tonight's pageantry made it a graceful exit for the striking workers. They remain convinced they're right, but their effort to force political and economic change will have to wait for another day. I'm Bill Buesenberg in Warsaw.
Citing the Fifth Amendment, retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North today refused, through his attorney, to provide a Senate panel with notes he took while he was involved in the Iran-Contra affair. North's attorney appeared before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, saying North would not release his notebooks because he has a right not to incriminate himself. The Narcotics Subcommittee is investigating possible links between efforts to help the Nicaraguan rebels and the international drug trade. Secretary of State George Shultz heads for Geneva tonight for talks with Soviet Foreign Minister Edvard Shevardnadze. It will be his 26th such meeting, and in less than 3 years, and one of the most important sessions to date. Barry Schweid reports.
The scheduled purpose was to finalize preparations for President Reagan's visit to Moscow beginning May 29th. But a treaty signed at the last summit in December is the main topic on Shultz's agenda. Last-minute differences with the Soviets over monitoring destruction of medium-range missiles have prompted the Senate to postpone ratification. A senior official traveling with Shultz has voiced optimism those differences can be resolved when Shultz, Shevardnadze, and their arms control advisors get together. But even if they do, the treaty may not be approved by the time the president goes to Moscow. And that could cloud the atmosphere for his fourth and probably last meeting with Mikhail Gorbachev. Hopes of signing another treaty to reduce long-range nuclear missiles have nearly vanished. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
The Supreme Court has blocked tomorrow's scheduled execution of James Edward Smith, a convicted killer jailed in Texas. The justices this evening granted an emergency request filed on behalf of Smith's mother. Smith, who received the death penalty for the 1983 slaying of a Houston man, has refused to appeal his conviction, saying he prefers death to life on death row. Federal safety investigators today unanimously accepted a report which cited crew errors as the probable cause of a Northwest Airlines plane crash that killed 156 people last year in Detroit. The report said the crew failed to go through the pre-flight checklist and that the plane's wing flaps and slats were not in the proper position for takeoff. The National Transportation Safety Board also said an interruption in the power line to an alarm system contributed to the crash. Democratic presidential frontrunner Michael Dukakis is heavily favored to win the primaries held in West Virginia and Nebraska today. According to the polls, he'll pick up most of the 62 delegates at stake. In both states, presidential politics is taking a back seat to hotly contested races for statewide offices. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street, ending 4 days of decline. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 6 points to close at 2003.65. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. There was a time when the only instruments a group of city kids needed to make music was their voices. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says the last gasp of a cappella singing was in the 60s as a reaction to the invasion of rebellious British rockers.
I have a strange theory about the way trends in rock and roll work. It says that there's a pendulum that swings between two poles. One, which we're at today, says that the music is something other people do. The other, which punk had us at 10 years ago, says that rock and roll is there for anybody to play who wants to. That's where things stood in the early 60s. The music was ripe for a do-it-yourself kind of change. Now, the Beatles ushered in one form of that change, but in the urban pockets of the Northeast, another little-known type of homemade music came onto the scene. It was the last flowering of doo-wop, the rich and complex vocal music which had more or less disappeared from the charts after the Jive Five's My True Story in 1961. It's hard to say when this new trend started, but around 1963, some record collectors in New Jersey came upon some rehearsal tapes by the Nutmegs, an obscure group that had hit with Story Untold in 1955. Here's Let Me Tell You.
Let me tell you that I love you. You have the shining like the stars above you. You know you're the only one for me. Let me put my arms around you.
These tapes had no instrumental backing and were completely a cappella. They were probably released just as a novelty and were played on a late-night oldies show. But something odd happened. Kids started showing up at the record stores that sold the Nutmegs record, asking to make a record themselves. And they all said the same thing. We sing without music, meaning instruments. Some of them, like the Camelots, had original compositions like Chain of Broken Hearts.
I'm on a chain, yes, a chain of broken hearts.
Others competed to see who could do the most intricate version of a classic. For slow songs, the standard was the Cadillac's Gloria. We just heard Philadelphia's Q-Tones roundly defeated by New York's Savoys on that one. For fast tunes, there was Stormy Weather.
There's clouds up in the sky. There's teardrops in my eye.
Stormy weather for
me.
I don't know why.
Why?
Oh, there's no sun up in the sky, it's stormy weather. Ever since we've been together, don't know why.
Don't know why.
There's no sun up in the sky. It's stormy weather.
Stormy weather.
Me and my gal ain't been together.
Been together.
It's raining all the time.
All time, all time, all time, all time.
Life is bad.
That was Stamford's Five Fashions with a fancy version complete with intro and the more streetwise Zircons from the Bronx with the basic version. From New Haven and Stamford in Connecticut through the New York, New Jersey area and down into Trenton and Philadelphia, a cappella caught on, mostly with poorer kids than the ones who were screaming for the Beatles, kids who remembered that it had hardly been 10 years ago that groups from their very high schools had made it big. The a cappella audience was big enough for record store owner Eddie Grease in Hackensack, New Jersey, to start a record label, Relic, to put out albums of it with defensive liner notes. He praised the groups for recording, quote, without the benefit of music, electronics, or multi-million-dollar sessions, unquote, and deploring the fact that, unfortunately, New York is starving for group sounds due to the mass brainwashing of the public with imported English garbage. By 1965, a cappella was a big deal on its home turf, but it wasn't growing. Some groups attempted to inject a more pop sound, like the Citadels with New Love Tomorrow.
There'll be a
new love
tomorrow,
do,
and no sorrow
tomorrow,
when my heart is free.
But the fact was, the lyrics weren't so hot, the recordings tended to be monotonous, and let's face it, some of that imported English garbage was pretty cool, and if you didn't like that, there was always the Four Seasons. In 1970, Frank Zappa, of all people, launched the career of the only successful group to come out of the whole movement, the Persuasions from Brooklyn, who have gone on to be favorites on the college circuit. As for the others, including Satan and the Angels, who once recorded a song that declared, "Girl, you are Trenton's medallion," and all the other hopefuls, they're just a footnote in the history of do-it-yourself rock and roll.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
I want a Sunday kind of love.
Wah-wah-oo.
A love to laugh at Saturday night.
Wah-wah-oo.
I want a love that's more than love at first sight.
Wah-wah-oo.
I want a Sunday kind of love.
This is Fresh Air. Elizabeth Benedict's second novel is a coming-of-age story about a kid growing up with parents who act like kids. Ann Tyler praised the book in a review for the Chicago Tribune and wrote that The Beginner's Book of Dreams deserves a high position in the growing ranks of truly excellent novels about those elderly children who serve as parents to their parents. The marvel is that such a sad book could be such a joy to read. The novel spans 10 years in the life of Esme Singer. Esme's parents divorced when she was young. Georgia, her mother, is an alcoholic who's had a series of live-in lovers. Esme's father is always scheming to make a fast buck and never comes through on his word. I asked Elizabeth Benedict if Esme's story was her own.
The story is not my family. The story is some of the characters in the story are based very loosely on people I knew when I was a child. But I do know something about growing up with an alcoholic, which The Beginner's Book of Dreams is very much about. It's sometimes when I read the book aloud, I'm struck by how vivid it is, and I imagine that readers imagine that I've just transcribed my life. And I'm always surprised by the fact that that's not true.
You said you know something about what it's like to grow up with an alcoholic parent. Was one of your parents alcoholic?
Yes, my father is an alcoholic who's no longer drinks, but I did grow up in a family with a drinking parent. And his alcoholism caused a lot of insecurity in the family, and because his behavior was so unreliable and unpredictable, we were all slightly off kilter a good bit of the time, wondering what was going to happen next.
What are some of the things that really rang true to you that you'd experienced that you put into the book about the kinds of ways that an alcoholic parent would let down or embarrass a child?
Well, I don't think that I was imitating or transcribing my own life in 95% of the Beginner's Book of Dreams. I think that Georgia became her own character, and the embarrassing things that she just sort of did as a character, not as a mirror of my own family or my own life. I knew someone when I was a child who was somewhat
Georgia
like
is the
Georgia.
Mother.
Georgia's the mother.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that she did, which I think is really indicative of alcoholic behavior, is that whenever Georgia comes to some realization about her life and about who she is, she gets drunk. And that's something that's not, as I say, doesn't deal with embarrassment to a child, but that is an important feature of Georgia's behavior that was important to me as I wrote the book. And so that her entire response to difficulties in her life is to get drunk. The effect on the child, of course, is that the parent is never there for them emotionally. And the effect on Esme is that her mother is never there for her.
There's a passage in your book I'd like for you to read that really, I think, gives a sense of how subject to change Esme's family always is.
Mm-hmm.
Would you read that passage for us?
Sure. This is Esme's father in the book, Meyer, is a schemer and a dreamer and something of a lovable con man. And he's mostly an absent character in the book. And he does make one very grand appearance. And he arrives when Esme is about 14 in a Rolls Royce with a new wife and her two children. And Esme is not quite sure whether he introduces the woman as his wife and then tells her that they're not really married. And Esme is supposed to pretend they're married for this visit they're about to go on. He wants to introduce this woman as his wife to his parents. Esme sat in the car, the marvelous car, with her father and these people she was supposed to pretend she was related to. She remembered the list of her mother's failings, the worst things her mother had ever done, the moronic things she did every day, every night, including doing it with some guy she went out with 2 weeks ago last Thursday, doing it loud enough so that it woke Esme up in the middle of the night and she thought her mother was being murdered, until she got up and crept into the living room and saw them on the couch in the dark, dark enough so that they didn't see her. She did not know what she was going to do with the list now, because she did not want to live with her father, with Tina, with these boys, with anyone. She had lived with so many people already. She had been related to so many people, but not really related. Esme closed her eyes now and counted up all of the stepbrothers and stepsisters she had ever had. It was like an accident, all of them ending up together in the same house and calling it a family. And then they would call it off, like stopping a movie in the middle, like stopping the car before you got to where you were going, pulling up on the side of the road and saying, "This is it, trip's over, visit's up."
How did you get that feeling that nothing in family is permanent, that things are always shifting, since your family wasn't like that? Did you do any research at all, like talk to children of families like that, or did you just imagine what it would have been like?
I think I did a lot of imagining, and there was, I think I had some concerns about convincing people of Esme's reality, because that was not my own reality. And I think I just sat in that car, in that Rolls Royce with Esme and all of these strangers, and I realized and I thought about and I felt what she must have felt then.
Your character Esme imagines what it would be like to be a grown-up. And I'd like to ask you to read a passage in which she imagines that.
Okay. The passage I'm going to read is what Esme thinks about when she's 8 and a half. And just before this passage, we've seen Esme's mother and her new husband have a terrible fight, and Esme's mother has walked out of the restaurant where they're having dinner, and we see how miserable their lives are together. And in this next scene, the scene I'm about to read, we've switched to Esme by herself. It would be wonderful to be a grown-up. She would stay up until the middle of the night. She would wear a bra, put it on that funny way Georgia did, leaning over to let her breasts fall into the cups. On Sundays, she would read the comics in the Daily News, even though Quinn said that it was low class, which she knew that she was not. She would have a signature that was different from anyone else's because they made you write a certain way in school and said you were wrong when you didn't. She would say hello, that particular grown-up way, when she answered the phone. She would take a lot of taxis and say, keep the change. Her boyfriends would take her to the sign of the dove and help her out of the taxi. She would wear a strapless yellow chiffon dress with a built-in bra to push up and out.
Now, this is a girl whose mother looks like Lauren Bacall. What do you think life would be like if your mother was that glamorous?
I think it would be very difficult. Esme, when she's a child, is plump. And I think partly because her mother is so beautiful, she grows up always in her beautiful mother's shadow. And even when Esme becomes prettier and slimmer, she has an idea of herself as an ugly duckling. And I think that's partly because of her mother's beauty and also partly because she's gotten so little support at home. It's not that anyone has ever told her she's unattractive, but her self-image, her internal self, her interior self, is so starved and so insecure that she puts herself down constantly. And one of the ways she does that is by putting down her appearance.
Is it important when you're writing, especially when you're starting out, to not hold back because you're thinking, well, gee, my mother might not like this passage, or a friend might think it's them I'm writing about and they might be insulted?
Yeah, I think it's one of the hardest things to me about being a writer is that you don't want to say anything that will hurt somebody's feelings. You don't want to, and the other thing is you don't want to say anything that will be too revealing about yourself, which of course what writing is all about. And so there's a constant struggle for me, and I imagine for a lot of writers, about how do I say what I want to say but still maintain my privacy, my identity. And it's a struggle, but it's also what writing is about. It's about breaking down those fears and those barriers and writing about the things that are difficult to write about and writing about things that, even if they're not literally what happened to me, they're feelings that I'm familiar with.
Okay, well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Elizabeth Benedict's new novel, The Beginner's Book of Dreams, is published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, the strike is over at the Lenin shipyard in Gdansk, Poland. After more than a week on strike, the workers there gave up, and they gave up without getting any of their demands met. Also today, we visit the State Department's Foreign Services Institute. That's a kind of social boot camp to prepare diplomats for the day-to-day encounters in a new country. The class we visit is preparing people who are about to go to the Soviet Union, and they get to find out things like how to handle themselves in restaurants and in stores and on the subway. It's a little bit of language and a lot of Soviet street smarts.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Book critic John Leonard has a review of William Boyd's new novel, The New Confessions. Boyd was born in Ghana and educated in Europe and England, where he now lives. His latest novel follows the political and cinematic adventures of a monomaniacal filmmaker.
William Boyd, who usually writes novels that are short and funny, like An Ice Cream War and Stars and Bars, turns in a long one this time that starts out hilarious and ends up exasperating. Boyd's anti-hero in The New Confessions is John James Todd, a filmmaker who manages to live through every minute of the 20th century while entirely missing its point. Born in Edinburgh in 1899, he gets to grubby London and the Western Front in time for World War I, to decadent Berlin in time for the Nazis, to smarmy Hollywood in time for the Blacklist. No matter where he is, even on an island in the Mediterranean, where he's menaced in his dotage by government agents, private detectives, bosomy Teutonic marine biologists, and lean spectral dogs, he's too busy making movies to notice history, for which, of course, he will be punished. Although in London, Berlin, and Hollywood, Todd makes many rotten movies, his ultimate ambition, never realized because history keeps getting in the way, is an epic translation to the screen of every page of Jean-Jacques Rousseau's autobiography, The Confessions. We hear a lot about this epic. It sounds so much like bad Wagnerian opera that maybe we're lucky it doesn't exist. But I like the idea. Rousseau pretty much invented the sort of romantic egotism that had to go into hiding after the excesses of the French Revolution. This romantic egotism lived on underground in the 19th century, in poetry and opera and even psychoanalysis, and I'm not surprised that it should make its 20th century comeback in the movies, with directors filming their own unconscious. Meanwhile, Todd himself is confessing to a life that corresponds in almost every important particular to Rousseau's. Dead mother, ambivalent father, globe-trotting, womanizing, and noble disappointment. He describes his many sins, lusting in boyhood for his aunt and in manhood for his brother's wife, deserting the mother of his four children, lying and stealing and maybe even murdering, and he expects us to forgive him. Not only did he do it for his art, but he is also merely a victim of chance and randomness in the universe, of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and Gödel's incompleteness theorem. This won't do, and William Boyd knows it, but he's busy himself having fun with his parodies and his pastiches of Isherwood in Berlin, of Evelyn Waugh in Hollywood, of Lawrence Durrell on an island, of Lawrence Stern in Tristram Shandy, of Robinson Crusoe, and Saul Bellow's Augie March. We have fun too, but after Todd has surfed through life on images, as if trench warfare were a photo opportunity, and Hitler a mean-minded film critic, and the Cold War a kind of campy Western, and women so many extras left on the cutting room floor, we begin to wonder whether the novelist has anything more to say about the century than his disagreeable character. After so much sadness and self-deception, is a dark chortle really enough?
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and as a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed The New Confessions by William Boyd. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. On our next show, an interview especially for listeners who always think they're coming down with a new disease. A talk with Susan Bauer, the author of A New History of Hypochondria. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Elizabeth Welch singing songs by Irving Berlin. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines the congressional debate over whether or not English should be the official language. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.